Welcome to Sunday School. It's good to see you. And so I want to give a little bit of a look ahead at next Sunday. Because next Sunday will be our final Sunday to look at the six-day creation week as a whole. We're going to look at cosmology. In other words, if you talk to most atheists, the number one reason why they say they don't believe in God or Christianity is they'll say because of modern science. So I don't believe in Christianity, I believe in science. And all the discoveries of cosmology in the last 20 years, you know, the vastness of the universe and how tiny we are, the age of the universe, it's left Christians very unsettled, because when they look at Genesis 1, it doesn't seem to have room for modern cosmology, the view of the universe. So we're going to consider that and see both what scientists and Christians have done with that. That's next Sunday. Today we're going to look at the six-day creation week is set up as temple building. And just to review last week, we looked at how the six-day pattern was used as a polemic against the other nations and their creation stories. And so we talked about how Moses didn't call it sun and moon because the sun and moon were worshipped by all the other nations. So he called it greater light and lesser light, which he never does again in Genesis. So right away we're seeing this is a polemic against the other gods, the other views who worship the sun and moon. The number seven, which is prominent in all the pagan the creation stories, the number seven is symbolically prominent. And so Moses uses the number seven throughout the creation week here. Adam and Eve, we talked about how Adam and Eve are unique in the creation account because they're the only ones who are talked about being formed from something. The birds just happen. God created the birds. But Adam is formed out of the dust of the ground, Eve formed from the side of Adam. And so there's something unique about man that is not given to the animals or everything else. But God still is the one creating. So they're not deities. Some viewed some men as gods. And they're not just like the animals. There's a uniqueness that only Genesis brings out. And so Todd Williams wrote, and this is a good summary, when the author wrote the book of Genesis, it is highly unlikely he was writing to answer Darwin's questions of evolution that would appear some 3,000 plus years in the future. What is more likely happening is the author is addressing competing creation stories of his time, stories that did not set Yahweh at the beginning. So I think you're getting hopefully a more appreciation for what we see in this, the way creation is explained. So now we're going to look at creation as a temple house for God. Some of the reasons we can see that in Genesis 1. First of all, on the seventh day, God rests over his creation. We talk about that word rest does not mean what it means in the picture. In the picture, it means God's tired. You work 6 days and now you get to rest. That's obviously not what it means. God cannot get tired. So we saw what it means in the Bible is that God rests in his palace on his throne. It's a resting over, it's a ruling over his creation. There's palace imagery of a king going out to battle. The battle's over, now the king sits on his throne over his creation. That's the picture of the word rest here. Now it's interesting that when we look at all creation as God's temple, when the tabernacle is given as God's temple, there are so many similarities between Genesis 1 and the tabernacle that you can't help but make the connection. For example, the temple consecration lasted 7 days. So when Solomon built the temple, it was consecrated 7 days. That obviously should bring you back to the seventh day of creation, the 7 days. God has built another temple, is the idea. The priests were consecrated for 7 days in the Old Testament to work in the temple. Pagan temple consecration took 7 days. So this was actually a common theme that they were familiar with. That even when the unbelieving nations built temples, they would have a seven-day consecration. So Moses was using what the people already understood and knew and were familiar with, and using that language now for the Lord. And it's interesting, the phrase, "and it was so," appears seven times, and God saw that it was good appears seven times. So John Currid summarized it, God is depicted in Genesis 1 as creating the world the way a craftsperson or a builder would. And what God is creating is a temple, a place of worship, where he resides and then man lives to worship God. Now especially, and I'm not going to get into the Hebrew, because I think most of you are not familiar with Hebrew, but you can even see, just looking at the words, that when the tabernacle is constructed, it sounds just like Genesis 1, that God is creating another temple. Let me give you some examples. And God saw all that he had made and found it very good. The tabernacle, Exodus 39. And when Moses saw that they had performed all the tasks as the Lord had commanded, so they had done. The Hebrew is the same here, the same words. It would even stand out more in the original. Creation 2:1, the heaven and earth were completed in all their array. The tabernacle, thus was completed all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. The same word for completed. Creation, Genesis 2:2, God finished the work which he had been doing. Tabernacle, when Moses finished the work. The same Hebrew. Creation 2:3, and God blessed. Tabernacle, Exodus 39, and Moses blessed. Creation 2:3, and God sanctified it. Tabernacle, Exodus 40, and to sanctify it in all its furnishings. You all see the point, right? So the tabernacle is a temple where God resides and where he's worshiped. Creation is his first temple. God builds it, sanctifies it as a holy place, the whole creation, and now he creates people to worship him in it. And so creation, like the tabernacle, is God's temple. And the psalmist brings this together in Psalm 29. The voice of the Lord twists the oaks and strips the forest bare, and in his temple all cry glory. What's the temple referred to here? Creation. Yeah, it's a psalm about creation. In his temple, the Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord is enthroned as king forever. And so the temple here is not the temple that was built. The temple is creation. And if you read that whole psalm, it's all about creation. So creation is called a temple. And so think of the connection. The cosmos is created as a temple, where his image bearers would look up and see his glory and then worship God. The Exodus is a temple where the Israelites would come and they would worship God in his presence. In the conquest, Solomon built a temple for the same reason. Now, the tabernacle moved around. It was a tent. The temple was one permanent place. Now, that's God's temple. Now, in the new covenant, God builds us, he saves us, and now we are called what? God's temple. So all this is going somewhere. This is what biblical theology does. It traces the progress of salvation, the progress of redemption. So we have the first temple, and we have the second temple, the tabernacle, the third temple, Solomon's, and then the final temple is us, that he has redeemed. Now, it's interesting that in the first three above, all of them have God subduing the waters to keep that theme together. So in Genesis 1, there's the waters of chaos over the earth. God needs to divide them. He needs to subdue them for his temple to be built where God's people can have a place. In the Exodus, we have the same thing, right? God divides the Red Sea. So God's people can come and do what? Worship him. Remember? I'm calling them out of Egypt to come worship me on my mountain. So again, the waters divide, and now there's a place to go worship God. In the conquest, they have to cross what? The Jordan River, which, what happens to the Jordan River? It is divided again. God's people go through, and there the temple is built, the land where God will be worshiped. And so you see the connection. All that is pointing to what Christ did to us by defeating sin and Satan over us and making us his temple. And so that theme of the waters divided keeps coming back whenever a temple is built. And so the picture is God redeems and then God builds. Now in Genesis 1, there's no actual redemption because it's just the waters dividing, but it is a picture of redemption. So God, let me just stop there. That's a lot of theology in 6 minutes. Yes, Ken. No, it's our conversion. And we talked about 2 Corinthians 4, where Paul writes, just like God shone the light, Genesis 1, God shines the light of the glory of God in us when he saves us. So he makes that connection between the light breaking apart the darkness and the gospel. And the same with the waters. Other thoughts before we go on? And so God builds as a master craftsman. That's the picture in Genesis 1. That's why he's pictured as a workman that comes down in our type of work week and builds something. It's a figurative picture of a week, because that's what we do. We go to work and we build. And so God is figuratively coming down in a 7-day pattern, and then he's finished. Now, the seventh-day Sabbath then was a sign for Israel that they wouldn't have to keep working forever. God would bring them into his rest. And that's what Hebrews brings out. God rested. We're down here. And we're still, man was still with Adam under a covenant of works. He had to prove himself. He had to obey to receive life. But one day that would all be done. And we would be in God's, we would see his glory, we would rest with him. So the Sabbath became a sign to Israel of the rest that's in Genesis 2, the rest of God at the end of the week. And so the point is that Genesis 1 is not a statement about biology or cosmology. It's about temple building and the hope of consummation, that seventh day rest is pictures something that we haven't entered yet. And of course, the writer of Hebrews says that's what Christ does for us. He saves us so we can enter his rest. And it's interesting, in Revelation 21, the New Jerusalem is described as a what? A temple. So now we are described as the eschatological, the final temple that even creation pointed to. The new creation in Christ is the final temple. This is the first temple. And so it's also a polemic, as we saw last week, but it is a temple project where now, and we'll see a little bit more next week of how that is seen with, even in the Garden of Eden, you have, just like the cosmos has, well, I'll save that for next week. But there are connections between the universe, the way it's made, and the Garden of Eden, and the different parts of the holiness of the temple as you get closer to God's presence. All right, we're going to talk about these quotes for a little bit, but any other thoughts? Yes? Yeah. Yeah, most of them saw the temple as eternal. The physical temple. We would always have a place where God is here with us, that it would never be destroyed. And that's why they were so offended when Jesus said, destroy this temple and I'm the temple. Yeah, the whole cosmos is designed as God's temple where we see his glory and we worship him. Right. That even the first creation is still a provisional or temporary one. Yes, and that includes the groaning from sin and people dying, right, and being buried in it. So you can see the problem of trying to make Genesis 1 answer all our scientific questions, and what are we losing about Genesis 1 when we do that? We're losing the gospel. We're losing the glory of why Moses did this. We're losing where the rest of the Bible goes as it looks back at this. And we're asking it to answer questions that Moses had no intention of or even would ever think about. All right, let's look at some quotes, and then I just want to get your thoughts if you understand them and what you think. Jeffrey Morrow writes a lot about this, and he writes, thus one may be able to perceive an increasing, here's what I was going to talk about, gradation in holiness from outside the garden proceeding inward. The region outside the garden is related to God and is very good in that it is God's creation, comparing to the outer court later in the temple. The garden itself is a sacred space separate from the outer world compared to the holy place in the temple. And then in the middle of the garden, and there you had God's priestly servant worshiping him, Adam. And then in the middle of the temple, you had where God dwells, the Holy of Holies, as a source of both physical and spiritual life, because the waters flowed down from Eden to give life to the area. And so he's saying, just as we've seen all the parallels to the temple already, here's another one. The creation had sort of three levels of holiness, just like the temple did. The closer you got to God in Eden, the more holy it was. And all this is, of course, a picture. And then Meredith Klein, the Creator had prepared in Eden an earthly replica of his heavenly dwelling as the holy place where man would fulfill his priestly office. And so if all of creation is a temple, Eden is the throne room in that temple. That's the picture. And so Adam becomes a priest to guard God's throne room. That's why when Adam fails to guard, who does God put into guard in Genesis 3? The angel with the flaming sword, the cherubim, they guard the very throne presence of God in the Bible. And so Morrow again, what we find in Genesis 1 through 3 is creation unfolding as the construction of a divine temple, the Garden of Eden as an earthly holy of holies, and the human person created for liturgical worship. Any thoughts on these? Yes. Not necessarily. It just means worship. They wouldn't have. I mean, they did offer offerings back then with Cain and Abel, but there is some question we talked about whether Adam would have known and used the tree of life at that point, but I don't think so. Liturgical doesn't always mean sacraments. It simply means religious. Yes, Chris. Yeah, I wouldn't say we are all priests after the fall. I would say Adam was appointed as a priest because he was told to guard and cultivate the temple. So he had a uniquely priestly role, is what Klein is getting at here, and Morrow. The rest of the people would be outside and, filling the earth. They wouldn't be there at the temple to... If Adam hadn't fallen, Adam would have been the priest in a sense. But once we get to the new covenant, the creation, we don't look at it the same. I mean, there are other ways to think about caring for creation, but I wouldn't say the priestly model is the New Testament model. Other thoughts so far? All right, a few more quotes. You could probably tell I like Meredith Klein, if you haven't figured that out yet. Eden was the sacred center of the earthly reproduction of the heavenly reality. Here in the garden of the Lord, the spirit glory that fills the heavenly temple was visibly manifested on the mountain of God. The revealed presence of the King of Glory crowning this sacred mountain marked the earth as a holy theocratic domain. Reflecting the identity of Eden as a sanctuary was the priestly responsibility assigned to man to guard the garden from profanation, from being profaned. So that's how Klein spoke, by the way. you ever read Klein, you almost need a dictionary. It's a Kleinian dictionary. It's not as bad as Klingon, but you know, he was a scholar and he wrote a scholarly way to students. He wasn't really writing to the public, sort of like trying to read a doctor's prescription. It helps if you have some medical training to know. But anyway, I think you get it. And so he's looking at creation as a temple. Eden was the sacred center of the temple. Eden is where God would live and where man would fellowship with God. And of course, we see that by Adam and Eve walking with, it says walking with, and we'll get to that later, God in the garden. All right, let's get to the Sabbath then. There's always a question about the Sabbath. The divine demand, this is Klein again, the divine demand for human imitation inherent in the Sabbatic pattern of the revelation becomes articulated in the fourth word of the Decalogue, that's the Ten Commandments. And so the argument is that the days must be literal 24-hour days because the Sabbath was introduced as a real 24-hour day. Right, in 6 days, God made and then rested, and so you work 6 days. And so Klein is showing how that's not the way to understand it, that the 6 days have to be literal 24-hour days because the analogy is. The comparison there drawn between the divine original and the human copy is fully satisfied by the facts that in each case there is the Sabbatic principle of a 6-1 ratio. The argument that Genesis 1 must be strictly chronological because man's 6 days of labor follow one another in chronological succession forces the analogy unnecessarily. The logic of such argument would not allow one to stop short of the conclusion that the creation days must have all been of equal duration and 24 hours at that. So one of the principles, analogies do not mean exact identity. And so because it says 6 days, and we already talked about the seventh day is not an exact identity, is it? Because God didn't only rest for one day and go back to work like we do. So if we wanted to say it has to be an exact analogy, then it would fail, wouldn't it? Because we get up after the one day rest. If you hold to the Sabbath, you go back to work. God didn't do that. He rests eternally. So if you try to say that the Ten Commandments force you to say that the 6 days are 24-hour days, it doesn't work. It's an analogy. It's a picture. And pictures of something are not exact identities. You know, the sacrifices were pictures of Jesus. But animals aren't Jesus. Right? There's an analogy between the two, but obviously not exact identity. And you can't argue, well, those animals couldn't picture Christ. They weren't people. Christ was a person. Well, that's not how analogies work, right? So that's one of the arguments that the days must be 24-hour literal days because the Sabbath pattern that looked back as that as a type was 24 hours. But that's, again, not how pictures work. Yes? It would leave you worshiping on Saturday to be consistent with the pattern of creation. If you're going to follow the creation pattern, you can't change to the first day when the pattern is the seventh day. Now, that's not answering the question, does the Sabbath continue today? That's answering the question of, does it have to be literal 24 hours because the Sabbath pattern was a 24-hour? That's what Klein is answering. Yes. Saturday, you mean? Well, for all of early church history, they didn't use the word Sabbath. They would use the Lord's Day. Yeah, it's more newer to call it the Sabbath today. At least church history-wise, you don't see that. You don't see the early church fathers saying, let's get together on the Sabbath. But they will use Lord's Day at times. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think so. So back to the theme of what Moses, under the inspiration of the Spirit, comparing the rest of the Bible, is doing, is we see a picture in a figurative account of 7 days of God coming down and building a temple for himself where man can worship. And then it becomes really glorious, what we're reading, if you see that. It's very devotional, isn't it? It's always sad to me when you take the devotion out of the Bible because you're asking the wrong questions. See, you wake up and you watch Fox News or CNN, whatever you're into, and BBC, if you really want good news. But then you hear all this stuff. Then you come here and you get this depth right away and your minds are... Yes. Yes. No, it was new to me too. When I studied under Klein, I had not done a study of Genesis 1 before that at all. I think most people who just think they know what it means have never actually studied it. And that was me too. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions? So next week, oh, go ahead. I mean, most scholars who obviously believe in inerrancy and inspiration think that they would have received this as they entered the Promised Land, which really goes to last week's, that it's also a polemic against all the other views they're about to run into in Canaan and what they heard in Egypt. Right. And of course, they would learn more when Moses revealed the tabernacle construction. They would have made the connections. The language was just too similar, especially in Hebrew. Yeah, do the Jews have an eschatology beyond the temple system? Is that what you're asking? Yeah, I mean, they would have a probation. They would know that there would be a time it'll be all blessing, no more judgment, but it not beyond the temple and the sacrifices. That was eternal. Yeah, the Messiah would come only to conquer and bring in the blessings. Right. Any other thoughts? All right, next week we're going to watch a little video first about the universe that really will blow your mind when you think about. And then we're going to ask, how does that connect to Genesis 1? What do we do with the unease among Christians when we see some of the statements in Genesis 1? Do we have to be concerned about modern science, or does it fit? So that's next Sunday. And let me pray.